Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, holiday greetings from our local men, women, and families serving in the military, and our third and final presentation of the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize winners. Today, we'll hear from Tim O'Brien, this year's recipient of the Richard C. Holbrook Distinguished Achievement Award. Up first, last week, WISO's Emily McCord filed a report for NPR about how Dayton has declared itself an immigrant-friendly city in order to stem population loss and boost the economy. It's an approach that's influencing the way other cities now deal with immigration.
Hey, defense! 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 Come get the ball!
Apparently, there's one common language that some recent immigrants to Dayton seem to share: soccer. It's now been a year since the immigrant-friendly plan was adopted here, and real change comes slowly. But this mini World Cup event is a start. A rainbow of brightly colored jerseys dot the field here, representing nearly 20 of the different immigrant communities in the city.
I've been really surprised to see that there are a lot of soccer going on around here at Dayton.
Adolf Bizniwayo left Rwanda as a refugee. He says Dayton has helped him transition to American life, and these World Soccer Games are playing an important role.
It just brings this joy, like we are home, like how we used to play soccer back at home when we play for hours and hours.
The so-called Welcome Dayton Plan aims to make newcomers feel that way. When the framework was adopted, City Manager Tim Reardon says it was for two reasons. First, it was the right thing to do. And secondly, immigrants were needed to restore this battered city's economy.
I saw immigrants doing things in the neighborhoods. They were buying really inexpensive houses and fixing them up. I heard stories from hardware owners where the immigrants would come and buy one window at a time to fix up their house as they got money.
Reardon says changing Dayton's culture is an investment in the city. For example, a section of town now is designated as an immigrant business zone. The plan also addresses law enforcement. Police now only check immigration status when there are suspicions of a serious crime.
We are seeing change.
Audrey Singer studies immigration at the Brookings Institution.
What's good about the Dayton program is the way that leaders in those communities talk about immigrants and talk about them as a positive force and contributing.
In fact, a Brookings study finds that immigrants are 30% more likely to form new businesses than U.S.-born citizens. That's good news for a city like Dayton that's been bleeding jobs and population for decades. But not everyone thinks this open-arms approach is a good one. Steve Salvi runs the Cleveland-based Ohio Jobs and Justice PAC, a group focused on illegal immigration.
The city is relying on the myth that the immigrants are, you know, going to be the savior of Dayton. And I think what the city needs to do is focus on helping native residents and make the city a place where people want to come and start a business if they're immigrants or native-born.
Salvi's concerned that Dayton could become a sanctuary city, a place harboring illegal immigrants. City Manager Tim Reardon says the term immigrant is not a synonym for illegal.
Frankly, the good people of Dayton didn't have that kind of attitude. It was the people from outside of Dayton. I got emails from Wyoming and Montana telling us what to do, and it's like, eh, that's not your business.
Besides, says Reardon, the real thrust of the plan is to focus on legal immigrants, like Francis Matias.
Hello, Antojitos.
Antojitos restaurant serves Puerto Rican food. Matias says they have specialty dishes like mofongo, plantains, which are fried and mashed.
We have all the seasonings here and all the pork, the butter, and now he's going to put the plantains in the mortar and start mashing.
Matias has worked hard to get his restaurant off the ground and is excited about Welcome Dayton. He thinks it makes it a little easier for people like him to start a business here, and that's different from other places.
In other states, it's either they're following immigrants and they trade like criminals. Here, it's great.
But there are signs of change. Other cities are now adopting plans similar to Dayton's. Cities like Tucson and Salt Lake City and others who are making it official policy to welcome immigrants and to help them feel at home. For NPR News, I'm Emily McCord.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this holiday season. In our final speech from the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize winners, we hear from Tim O'Brien, this year's recipient of the Richard C. Holbrooke Distinguished Achievement Award, a Vietnam veteran. O'Brien is best known for his memoir, If I Die in a Combat Zone, Box Me Up and Ship Me Home, as well as his 1990 story collection, The Things They Carried.
I don't want to begin my remarks tonight by talking about Vietnam. I want to begin in the here and now. I am 66 years old, and I am the proud father of my first children, a young boy named Tad, who's now sleeping over here in a tuxedo. He's 7 years old, and an older kid who's just barely awake named Timmy. And I want to begin with an anecdote about these kids. A couple of years back, I caught the younger kid, Tad, in our bathroom of our house, peeing into a wastebasket. And not just a wastebasket, but a wire mesh wastebasket. And not just a wire mesh wastebasket, but a wire mesh wastebasket situated on top of a fairly new maroon carpet that we had laid in the house. Well, I was astonished. The kid knew better. And I said to him, "Why are you doing this?" And I'm ordinarily a pretty quiet guy with my kids, but there was a certain earnestness in my voice. And it paralyzed Tad. He turned back toward the toilet, but made it only halfway. And finished the job, midway between. Over and over, I said to Tad, "Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this?" And my wife heard me, Meredith, and she came scampering in, and she took charge of the disciplining duties. I retreated to my study, where I kind of muttered to myself for an hour and a half. And after, an hour or so, little Tad came toddling into the study, and he said, "Daddy, Daddy." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I have two heads." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I have two heads." And I said, "What?" And he said, "You asked why I did it, and it's because I have two heads. One head said, 'Daddy's not going to like this.' And the other head said, 'This is going to be fun.'" Well, immediately I had been conceiving of this, he was then 5 years old. I thought I was bringing up a serial killer or a juvenile delinquent. I imagined him at Huntsville, getting executed by Governor Perry. But the respect I suddenly had for the sophistication of this two-headed thought really struck me. There's a tradition in our house that I'm a writer, and so not only do I tell stories to my kids, from books and so on, and Thumbelina or Hansel and Gretel, but on occasion, pretty much every night, I make up my own stories. And that night, as I lay in the dark, flanked by Timmy on one side and Tad on the other, I began a story by saying, "Once upon a time, I knew somebody with two heads." And in the dark, Timmy sat up and said, you're kidding. I mean, are you really?" And I said, "Yeah, really." And Tad sat up on the other side and said, "What was his name?" And I said, "His name was Daddy." Both kids kind of leaned in simultaneously, kind of looking at my neck, looking for the stump of that extra head. Well, over the course of the next, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, I began telling them a kind of cleaned up, Ajaxed, sanitized version of a chapter in one of my books. The book is The Things They Carried, and the chapter is a chapter called On the Rainy River. It's the story of the summer I became a soldier, in the summer of 1968, the summer I was drafted. I explained to these two kids that that summer, before going to the war, before even being in the Army, was in many, many ways much more problematical and much more personally traumatic than anything that happened to me in Vietnam itself. I was in control. I could say yes. I could say no. I could head for Canada. I could head for jail. Or I could head for a war. I told them I was 21 years old, and I was opposed to the war in Vietnam. It seemed to me then, as a kid, if that's the appropriate word for a 21-year-old, but it seems to me now as a 66-year-old, that you don't go off killing people unless you're fairly sure it's the right thing to do. I told them that, you know, the best one could say about Vietnam was that certain blood was being shed for uncertain reasons. The bodies were for sure. The maimed were for sure. The widows were for sure. The orphans were for sure. The Gold Star mothers were for sure. Nobody disputed it on any side politically. But as anyone who lived through that war knows, the reasons for the war were at best suspect. Hawks at the throats of doves, smart people not able to make their minds up about the rectitude of the war, people at Congress divided, the nation divided, my own family divided. What do you do if you're 21 years old and you're told to go kill and perhaps die in a war that you don't believe in and that the country doesn't seem to believe in, at least in terms of consensus? Well, by this time, Timmy and Tad are asleep. And there I am, lying in the dark, flanked by these two precious little boys, telling myself for the upzillionth time the story of that summer of 68, in which it felt as if I were bearing two heads. One of these heads, you know, situated, say, over here, was a lover of my country, a believer in sacrifice for country. My dad had been a sailor during World War II off of Iwo Jima and Okinawa. My mom had been in the Waves, adjunct of the Navy back then. In fact, they had met in Norfolk, Virginia during the war. In a way, I was a child of war. On the other hand, there was another head up here, believing in all the same virtues of service to country and loving America, but also a head that wanted nothing to do with the Vietnam War, certainly not to kill people, and even more certainly not to die. I was 21 years old. I was terrified. And through the summer of 1968, those two heads endlessly confronted each other, challenging and mocking and debating and taunting and cussing, invoking God and the names of LBJ and Richard Nixon and Jane Fonda and Abby Hoffman and Patrick Henry and Daffy Duck. A whole litany of history going through my head. Now and then, these two heads would speak rationally to each other in the Minnesota dark as I tried to decide, should I go to this war or not? Other times, the two heads would be seeming to scream the most outrageous obscenities at each other, screaming the black and white kind of platitudes that were being screamed all across this republic of ours through the hot summer of 1968. I was not now telling the story to Timmy and Tad, but I was telling it to myself, as I will tell it again tonight when I go to bed at the Marriott, as I will tell it tomorrow night and the night thereafter until probably the day I die. Now and then, one of these heads might score a sterile rhetorical victory. And at other times, the other head will win the day. Sometimes one head might say to the other, "What a coward you were for going to that war. You couldn't say no because you were too embarrassed to utter that word. Embarrassed in hometown, small town America. Embarrassed to hear your girlfriend utter that word. Family. And then the other head will say, give me a break. You did what your country asked you to do. And the other head will chuckle and say, all right. And what if my country asked me to blow up Toronto tomorrow? Do I just do it? Is that what we mean by patriotism? Anything? Automatic? Sacrifice your integrity and your conscience? And the other head would say, very sternly, come on. You live in a great and good nation, a country that would never issue such an order. Don't be ridiculous. And the other head will say, ah, well, what about My Lai? What about the American Indian? What about weapons of mass destruction that did not exist? What about robber barons and pinstripes? What about McCarthyism? What about Hollywood blacklists? And the other head will say, come on, everybody makes mistakes. And the other head will say, exactly my point. Everybody makes mistakes. And finally, one of these two heads will say, come on, let's go to sleep. And at 2 or 3 in the morning, I'll go off until the next night when the two heads, when these two heads begin talking to one another once again. Well, it strikes me now on this wonderful occasion, an occasion that I would never have dreamed of 40 years ago, as I lay at the bottom of an irrigation ditch in Vietnam, listening to men die all around me, screaming the word mom and dad and mommy and mama, and listening to the voices of the dying Vietnamese all around me as well. It strikes me on this occasion that it's important to give a bow to two-headedness, to the complications and ambiguities of this world that have to do with what Mr. Holbrooke was all about as a diplomat and what I think we are honoring here. We're honoring, in a way, a desire for common sense, to pay attention to that, those important questions of what we die for and what we kill for, if anything, and to find ways to avoid the dying for and the killing for, if at all possible. Part of being an adult, part of being human, I think, as opposed to being, say, a chipmunk, is that at certain points in our lives, we will all carry upon our heads 2 or more heads. It can be a curse. It can lead to wee hour second guessing, as it has for me over the last 4 decades, endless speculation about what could have been or what should have been. You in this audience may well find yourself now and then doing exactly what I do every night, lying in those beds, revisiting through a story or through memory a moral choice you made or failed to make or would make differently. Two heads can be a problem, but two heads can also be the sign of an open mind, of a mind attuned to the world's pesky ambiguities and complexities and mysteries and uncertainties, of a person sophisticated enough to understand that knowledge can be imperfect and that one's own judgment may be dead wrong or may revolve or refine itself. To carry through two heads through life, however burdensome, however dispiriting, may help to avoid the soul-killing, people-killing mistakes of absolutism Muhammad Atta, the hijacker and final pilot of one of those airliners that struck the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, had but one head, a bonehead at that, an absolutist of the most consummate and deadly sort. Atta thought he knew the final and definitive truth of things, a truth worth killing for, and a truth worth dying for. Let us not, let me not, and you not, commit the same one-headed sin of vanity and complacency and self-righteousness and demagoguery and fanaticism and zealotry and simple-minded black and white, you're right and I'm wrong, absolutism. After the events of recent years, I have come to fear that our own nation, as much as any other nation, is endangered by such slick, self-centered, absolutist rhetoric that erases our own national shortcomings, erases our own ethical and moral failures, torture, for example, in favor of a vision of America as somehow exceptional and beyond the norm. It is a great and good nation, and we can recognize that while also looking bluntly and directly at the facts of the world we live in. I conclude by coming back to that irrigation ditch that I mentioned to you a few moments ago. The month was July, the year was 1969. I was then had a rank of a Spec 4. Our company had been operating near where the My Lai massacre had taken place. It hadn't yet been exposed. No one knew about it except those who did it. And, of course, the Vietnamese lived through it. And in a ditch not far from where that massacre happened, about a year prior to my arriving in Vietnam, our company had been pinned down by heavy machine gun and mortar fire. And we'd taken refuge, many of us, not all of us, in a ditch that was, I suppose, thigh deep or knee deep, depending on where you were in the ditch, in slime, a mix of paddy water and algae and leeches and human waste. The stink was unbelievable. And in my dreams and in my waking hours as well, I can still hear the voices of those people, not just dying, but badly wounded, and the voices of the Vietnamese too. And at the bottom of that ditch, somehow, as this half-hour firefight went on, I became a writer. It wasn't said in that language, I'm going to write. It was more a feeling of somehow, some way, I'll bear witness to this. I'll testify. I will not stay silent. I will not stay silent after all the silence that I had exercised in going to this war, the silences that I had, to my great discredit, committed as I watched evil after evil and sin after sin being perpetrated. I would not stay quiet. For 40 years, I haven't shut up, and I will not. Thank you so much to Dayton. And thank you so much for an award that means the world to me. Good night.
Tim O'Brien, this year's recipient of the Richard C. Holbrook Distinguished Achievement Award. On New Year's Day, WISO will bring you a special presentation of the speeches from writers honored with the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the final week of early winter. In a warm winter morning not long ago, in soft rain, The grass outside my door was lush and bright. The last Osage leaves were golden above the shed. Along the west wall of the house, wild onions were getting lanky and motherwort was bushy, and one Queen Anne's lace plant had grown back 2 feet tall. Inside the garden, fresh rosemary, thyme, oregano, fat chard were still good for picking. Strawberry leaves were turning red and orange, and dry pumpkin brown heads of marigold quivered in the wind. By the pond, the lamb's ear was still velvety gray, and there was blush on the wild geranium. By the front door, dusky forsythia leaves still blocked the street from view. Pink azalea leaves were forecasting their spring blossoms. There was new chickweed under the rhododendrons, new clover, 2 new dandelion blossoms, the ground ivy deep summer green. Under the apple tree, 1 wild strawberry was flowering, and to the side of the woodpile, very late blue forget-me-nots. Along the north hedge, orange euonymus berries were pushing out from their white pods. Butterfly bush and comfrey, dock, garlic mustard were all vigorous. Fat rose hips were surrounded by mint against the old stone wall. "And all shall be well," they said to me. "All manner of things shall be well." This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of deep winter. In the meantime, be at peace as this old year comes to a close. In spite of all our differences and with our losses and our gains, we are of one fabric. And all manner of things shall be well.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
My name is Specialist Parker Haley. I want to give a warm shout out to my family and friends back in Wilmington, Ohio, here from Heidelberg, Germany. Happy holidays.
We're the Whitlock Family Station out here in Kaiserslautern, Germany. We want to wish everybody in Middletown, Ohio, my in-laws, a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Hi, I'm Wanda Teagarden, and I'm deployed to Kabul, Afghanistan. I want to wish a happy holidays to my very best friend, Frida, and to her husband, Vic, in Franklin, Ohio.
Hello, I'm Lieutenant Leon Moore, the Public Affairs Officer for Combined Joint Task Force Paladin here in Bagram, Afghanistan. I would like to wish my mother, Carolyn Moore of Dayton, Ohio, happy holidays. I'll see you soon.
Hi, we're the Young Family stationed in Baumholder, Germany, and we just want to say a very Merry Christmas to our friends and family in Lebanon, Ohio. Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Hi, this is the Horning family stationed here at Stuttgart, Germany, wishing our family and friends back in Dayton, Ohio, a happy holidays. We miss you guys. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Yay.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Paul Baldwin, and this is my family. This is my wife, Michelle, my son, Tyler and Connor, and my daughter, Sydney. We're serving here at Ramstein Air Base, Germany. And we'd like to wish our family and friends back in Kettering, Ohio, and the surrounding area a happy holidays. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Tammy Dotson. This is Victoria and this is Taja. We're stationed at Aviano Air Base in Italy. Want to send a special shout out to my sister, Colonel Regina Goff, stationed at Wright-Patt Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and her husband, Edward. Happy holidays. We miss you and we love you.
Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Berninger from Bagram, Afghanistan, with the Joint Combat Casualty Research Team. I'd like to wish happy holidays to my family in Dayton, Ohio, and to my kids, Adler, Alina, and Avriel, and husband Wes in Schofield Barracks, Hawaii. Happy holidays.
My name is Private Curtis Estep. I'm with ACO 121 here at Schofield Barracks, and I'd just like to wish my parents a Merry Christmas back in Lebanon, Ohio.
Hello, my name is Captain Jason Friels. I'm currently assigned to Incirlik Air Base in the Republic of Turkey. I'd like to say hi to my mom and dad, Jim and Jane, as well as the rest of my family there in the Miami Valley area. I miss you guys. I hope to see you soon, and I want to wish all of you a very happy Christmas and a very happy 2013.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.